This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
This is The 11th Hour. I'm Páraic Branagh. Welcome to this week's selection from The 11th Hour podcast. Tonight we're coming to you live from Galway City for a special programme celebrating Máirtín O'Coin's literary masterpiece, Cén na Cille. This year marks the centenary of O'Coin's birth in Cnocán Glas in Cois Aireagain, Connemara in 1906. As part of the celebrations, Rosc Films have produced a film adaptation of the novel. Cén na Cille, or Graveyard Clay, is a modernist narrative written in Irish and set in the graveyard of a small Connemara village, where the characters carry on dialogue, gossip and spitefully well into their graves. The film got a special screening in Galway City last Saturday and will be broadcast on TG Cahir in the new year. To discuss the importance of Cén na Cille and Máirtín O'Coin, I'm joined in the Galway studio by Louis Dupuir from University College Galway, radio drama producer Cathal Portair, producer with Rosc Films Ciarán O'Coffey, film director Robert Quinn, and actress Breedy Naughton joined us in our Dublin studio. You're all very welcome. Cathal, firstly, can you give me sort of a thumbnail sketch of O'Coin's life?
Well, briefly, he was born in 1906 in an Crochan Glass just outside Spigil in the Connemara Gaeltacht. Was brought up there, got a scholarship to St. Patrick's College, Drumcondra, where he went and trained as a primary school teacher, and taught for a number of years, mostly in Connemara. His republicanism led him to fall foul of the authorities, and he lost his teaching posts. And he, in later life, was interned on a number of occasions, on the second occasion during the Second World War, for, I think, about 4 years. On being released from that, he tried to make a living, basically, with an amount of writing, and also he later was employed, having spent years in a government prison camp, ended up as a translator in the houses of the Oireachtas. And after that was given a post as a lecturer in Trinity College Dublin, a lecturer in Irish, later to become professor there.
It was quite an achievement for a Republican rabble-rouser to become professor of Irish in Trinity College.
Well, I think Trinity College was probably one of the few places where it could happen.
Louis, as an Irish scholar, when did you come across O'Coin?
Well, I suppose I came across him when I was studying as an undergraduate in Cork, although, in a sense, there wasn't that much attention paid to him, that Seán Ó Riordan was the great master, when you're coming from a Cork perspective. But I suppose, in a way, the fact that we didn't study him as closely as we should have tells you a little bit about the critical neglect of his work, even in the Irish language, the kind of industry that's grown up around Joyce, for instance, or Yeats, or even more latterly, around Seamus Heaney. That doesn't really exist. I think that O'Coin is still relatively unexplored territory, even within the Irish language, from people who should be really looking at him more closely than they do.
But even in, say, University College Galway, he wouldn't have been central to their thinking or their curriculum.
Well, in fairness, I suppose Gary Denver is the first person to have published a full-length book study of his work.
That's in the 70s, 80s.
That's absolutely correct, yeah. And I suppose it's partly to do with the perceived difficulty of his work. And I'm not sure that his work is quite that difficult. It's certainly not more difficult than Davy O'Brúather and Éagán O'Rahilly, nor is it more difficult than Táin Bó Cúaillne. But in the 70s and 80s, it was compulsory to read extracts from Old Irish, and it wasn't compulsory to read Máirtín O'Coin. And it's still the case that in most of our universities, a person can get a BA in Irish without reading a word of O'Coin. I think myself that that's scandalous.
Anyway, we have O'Coin here, talking about his writing, and lecture he gave the Cumann Merriman in the late 60s. Let's listen to this, please.
Sin kynal kene ihok semus makri anales. Diach mele se loch da ta dar lom er ingri anach a hachant. Diach mele mocha tene spien al thama se hiara. Bishoch beg ebe ma hiara, shachas mar huwed mei. Karim shach mal an leir vastori warenti. Goma buinti re sandu lo bach te jun ter fada hort. Is anan sio agas a heena nach skrinio charabbe mei.
He says there that the credit for his writing, Cathal, was given to his people, as if he was never a writer himself.
Yeah, well, I think really what he was talking about there was that the wealth of language on which he was able to draw came from the Connemara Gaeltacht, from what he heard growing up. Even though he made no attempt to be a writer who based his writings on folklore and in fact criticised people who did. At the same time, when he talks about language as one of the things that he depends on and uses. He references many places where he would have sourced that language, primarily within his own family and his own parish, but he would also have gone further afield. He would have gone to older literature, he would have gone to folklore, he would have gone to the folklore journal, Baileges, he would have gone to Scotland if a word didn't exist for something
and
in Connemara.
Well.
He made it up and made no bones about it if he needed a word to describe something. But he made them up in a way that he felt was perfectly understandable to anyone who had reasonably good Irish. It was made up in the way that words had always traditionally been made up to suit new occasions, to suit new things.
Corkery and other Corkmen criticised them as characters as being folkloric or folklore characters.
Well, now that was specific to Creagh na Cille,
yeah.
And in a sense, I'd almost agree with Corkery about that, but it's also perhaps a misunderstanding of what he was trying to do with Creagh na Cille. In a sense, it's to my mind, it's unfortunate that there's been so much emphasis put on Creagh na Cille in the year of his centenary. My own feeling is that the best of O'Kane's work is in the short stories. Creagh na Cille is an extraordinary book. It's a one-off. It's a miracle that it works at all. I mean, it defeats the laws of literature in the same way that a bumblebee defeats the laws of gravity. You know, it plays so fast and loose with the ordinary rules of construction that it is quite extraordinary that it does fly, but it does nonetheless. The difficulty for me, I think, is that it's a book that is so negative in its portrayal of human behaviour, or at least the Connemara version of human behaviour, that it's kind of lopsided unless we go to the short stories. And the short stories are provide extraordinary insights into the lives of ordinary people in Connemara during O'Kane's own childhood, perhaps their resilience, their sense of endurance, and they're filled with the most extraordinary humanity. I mean, it seems to me in the same way that we have Seamus Heaney's Derry and Joyce's Dublin, that O'Kane's Connemara is at least as central to the way we see ourselves as Irish people as any of those.
Atoma, another Corkman, said that O'Kane wrote the most consciously patterned and richly textured prose any Irishman wrote this century, this last century was talking about, with the exception of Beckett and Joyce. Would you agree with that?
I think that's completely true, and I would disagree only very slightly with Cahill in the sense that O'Kane is difficult linguistically, and part of the difficulty is, it seems to me, that he understood that the Irish language was in decline during his own time, and I think he consciously set out to, if you like, establish a storehouse.
Well, put every word he knew into the book.
That's part of it, but there is an attempt, there's a salvage operation for the language so that in future generations we wouldn't have an attenuated form of the Irish language, that we would have a greater sense of the possibilities of it. And for that reason, he mixes the vernacular with various literary usages. He tells us himself he uses material that he heard tinkers in Scotland using, and he's doing it to actually extend the range of the Irish language. So when people say O'Kane is difficult, he is linguistically challenging, but he's not difficult in any other way. And as Christopher McAneese pointed out some 40, 50 odd years ago, that if Irish had survived in better shape, he wouldn't be seen as difficult at all, that it's a measure of how far the language has contracted that even people like ourselves would find him difficult up to a point.
Let's listen to a bit of Mac Dara Farta narrating from the radio play of Stuck the Kidja. Let's listen to the voice of Stuck the Kidja.
Níl am na bethe sa gill, níl sarachas na darachas an, níl fin gireine ráchtal wanechas guíche na cluich mú an, cá an chill a deach mo hén na áil ón meo, éste la mo glór, cá fyr éste.
That was a clip from Carl Porter, who's here beside us, and his Radio 1 production of Creagh na Cille. Ciarán, what exactly is the book Creagh na Cille about?
Well, I think in essence it's about the rivalry and the jealousy between two sisters, Cathaoirne Foidhín, who's the central character, and Nell Foidhín, her sister. And that goes back to a time when Nell stole her love away from her. This is Jack na Scoláige. And since then, she could never forgive her sister Nell. And this sense of bitterness and jealousy is so strong that it exists into the afterlife. And in the film, we begin with the death of Cathaoirne Foidhín, as is with the Leabhar, but we begin above ground or in this world. And basically, we look at the story from this world and the next throughout the film. We were cutting between this world and the next. And but I would say the essence of the story is that rivalry.
At the time that O'Kane wrote this, Louis, it was kind of like there was a movement in European literature towards exploring this eternal dimension of Beckett was at the same area of exploration at the time.
I think what's very interesting about Crane and Kill is that on one level it's very challenging and very experimental and very groundbreaking, but on the other hand I think it's actually deeply embedded in the Gaelic tradition that it's all talk and it's all about people besting each other in talk. And O'Kane himself was conscious of his own ambitions to become an experimental writer and to break away, as he saw it, from the shackles of folklore. And yet he found that, to his own consternation, people were reading out Crane and Kill to each other in houses in Connemara. They were reading to each other in the bog. And he said people were adding to it as they would to folklore. They made their own of it. And I think it's actually much closer to the native tradition, if there's such a thing. It's much close. It's actually very familiar to Gaeltacht people, for all that we talk. And in a way, I suppose, we might be mystifying it too much by emphasising the experimental features. And I think one of the things that's interesting when it becomes a radio play or a stage play, and I'm sure a film as well, is that because the talk lifts up off the page, it's actually much more comprehensible and easier to understand. Mm. And I think that's his great, great gift. I mean, the talk is just fantastic. You know, it's like overhearing the most spiteful, venomous, bitchy conversations imaginable in a pub endlessly.
Yeah. And the curses are curses, like they're all of these. It's not just a curse as we understand it.
And when you do hear it, I think the humour of it comes through. Sometimes if you are having linguistic difficulties trying to make your way through Crane na Cille, sometimes you can lose sight of the humour, but on the recent stage version and in the radio play, the humour comes
through. And certainly in the film as well.
From the characters, the bitchiness, the undercurrents that go through it. And it makes it seem very simple. As Louis says, it isn't that difficult in a way, because the story in itself is reasonably simple, and in fact it may be too simple. The plot is quite thin, but you get through it on the strength of what the characters say to each other.
There's a lovely moment there from when MacDara O'Farrell's production was on the stage at the Tyverk a number of years ago, Pádraic, and a load of older people from Connemara were brought into the preview of the play, and with 10 minutes into the production they started talking back to the characters on the stage that they felt they were so familiar to them. And I'd heard the story and asked Joe Steve O'Neachton, was it true? And he said it was true, and it was almost impossible to perform. But it gives you a sense of just how close the language of the play and how close his insight into the characters is to reality. He's a very realistic writer. For all the flourish and the linguistic virtuosity, it comes down finally to a really extraordinary level of insight into real people in living actual lives.
Robert Quinn, you have a writing credit on this, and that you worked with Dara Flaherty to adapt the movie. Did you find it difficult to get all this dialogue into one feature?
Hugely. Well, actually, to be honest with you, at the start I was quite worried about getting involved in the film, because it was, you know, a very unwieldy piece, and also because it was set under the ground and the characters were all stuck in their coffins, so we had to change that instantly. I think the catalyst for me was going to see MacDara's play, actually, where the characters had freedom and they moved about. So when MacDara and I sat down to discuss how to make it sort of cinematic, the first thing we said about was well, taking out Stuck na Cille, actually, the large monologues that punctuated each of the deaths, and by replacing them with the deaths themselves above ground. And that was a kind of a starting. And once we'd broken that kind of rock of Crane na Cille, that we felt more kind of allowed, we were allowing ourselves to do that, then we started to decide that we would show aspects of what was being said below ground above ground, you see.
So you create another world, parallel world to the below ground world.
Well, we created humanity. We showed the real living people above ground. Nell, we showed Billichy and Fusta. All of these characters were spoken of. So, I mean, in a way, as if in making films, what you have with Crane na Cille is a huge exposition. Right, so what we were trying to do above ground was show these people rather than just talk about it, you know, and that was the starting point. And I think MacDara did a great job in terms of helping me edit the dialogue as well, because we haven't put every single aspect of Crane na Cille into the film, and we haven't even put every single aspect from the stage play into the film neither.
That Stuck na Cille, Louis, was an interesting device, wasn't it?
I think it's the dullest part of the writing, though. I do, in the same way that I think that some of the aspects of Ulysses, for instance, that drew most attention when it was first published, are actually the least interesting and the pieces that have most poorly stood the test of time. And I think the same with Stuck na Cille, and it's one of the reasons why the thing again comes alive when you begin to scale back. I mean, O'Kane is an excessive writer. in all kinds of ways. He goes too far. He goes over the top. He is indulgent of himself. Verbally.
Boring verbosity, the Sean O'Toole
McCullough. Oh, very capable of it. I mean, very capable. And we must also remember that this comes out in 1949. He's at quite an early stage of his development at that stage. He becomes a much more sophisticated, clean writer a bit later. I mean, he's a very untidy writer. Somebody said to me, I was working on translation of his work earlier this year with Mike McCormack, a really good Mayo writer. And Mike said, he's as clumsy as Dostoevsky. You know, that he has this huge vision that has to be expressed one way or another.
And he was influenced by the Russians, wasn't he?
Hugely influenced. Maxim Gorky was a huge influence on him. And in a sense, the breakthrough between his 1939 collection, Idir Húgragas Dáiríre, which beyond the linguistic interest, I think, is a very dull collection of stories. The breakthrough that happens while he's in prison and is evidenced in the 1948 collection on Brian Brough, where suddenly you have this form of social realism that he's borrowed from Maxim Gorky and applied to his own experience amongst his own people. Interesting here is that Tomás O'Criffin also was enabled to write and speak about his own people by his encounter with Gorky. It was the first time he discovered the peasant life of his own people written about in a familiar way to him. And O'Kane says the same thing. He says it was almost like the conversion of St. Paul on the road to Damascus, that he suddenly realised the life of people in Connemara has already been written about, only in Russian.
Let's hear a clip from the radio version of Cliona Cilla, produced by Carl Porter, where Catriona Foidín meets her neighbour, Muireann Freundseis, on her arrival in the grave.
Bishop Catriona Foidín, Queen of let me worry it. No one you mean, Queen and Teal as were gone, and she?
Ah, seal cannot and just be an old country, eh? August Tom on the goose and I reached the Catriona. Codin Chahu, eh?
Near the same Codin Shame. Near the same would be a loyal poor, I know long the yeshin if I'd my boss. We met a cleat, no doin.
Heribly on a go cosh, you'll find my hain boss.
See, right. Scar a gitty nearly go my walk porrix and arry down ye vime. Nell a honig malroch morale to machine and was a mohun. Tamuret, friend, she's a seer who boss, she just she. Misha could not out dog yer to worret. Leg me hain a goes coach vega macho.
That was Bridie Nachton and Morny Renan. In the radio version of Cliona Cilla, Bridie Nachton Tatunchen.
Tana Farik.
I'm finding it very difficult as a gentleman to speak in English tonight, because I normally speak to the people around me in Irish, so if we break into Irish in the middle of it, you'll forgive us. Anyways, Bridie, you have the luck or the fortune of playing Catriona Foidín in the radio version, the stage show, and the film.
That's right. I think people think I'm sort of an expert on O'Kane by
now. That's why I have you here. You were the expert on Catriona Foidín. Tell us a bit about Catriona Foidín. What kind of character is she?
Well, she's a very quiet woman, Porrick. She never utters a word. She arrives in Cliona Cilla full of venom and bile, and she refuses to give up the ghost, and she wants to know what's happening to Nell, and every character that comes her way, she gives them stick.
She's still living in her former life, wondering what went on in the village.
Absolutely, absolutely. She wants to know what's happening, who's doing what to who, and who, you know. She's not prepared to die.
I've just noticed in your character in the film and in the play and in the radio play, there's a power of cursing in it, isn't there?
There is, yes, there is, yeah.
Could you give us an example of the best curse in the film?
Oh, in the film?
Yeah, aren't the same curse in them all, in fairness?
well, she... She calls Nell a ratloch. She calls her Thún Saranach. She calls her, calls Tomás Rua a Chonúis Chaka. She tells him, Persily ar the street. She says, a wager loch vradach. And I'm going to let Louis de Peyre translate all of those for you.
Well, you mentioned Thún Saranach, Louis.
I think we should refer people to the standard dictionaries to check out all those terms.
I
think people should phone up Conor na Gaeilge first thing in the morning and Ron O'Gonestruchain and then question Tiarmaíochta and find out.
in the absence of the academics giving you a translation, then a gentleman, I will endeavour to do it myself.
I suppose it's arse in the ferns.
Arse in the bracken. Ratloch is...
Hussy.
And Cunnus Chaka.
It's a Cunnus is a dead carcass, and Chaka is shitty dead carcass.
Bneed, you are from Connemara yourself.
Yes, and I use these words every day, Porrick.
No, but genuinely, would you have heard that level of cursing and backbiting in Connemara, or was Mortian and Kyle invented all?
Oh, not at all. Of course you would. I mean, he says himself he based all these characters on Muintir Chasharige, you know, in 1949. Yes, to answer your question, yes, there were people like Caitríona Foidín all over Connemara, in Rossmuck, in Spittle, and, you know, the one-upmanship and the, you know, the spitefulness and the begrudgery and all of that, it existed. And people say it still exists today.
I wonder why that would be. Would anybody like to comment on that? Is it social circumstances that people are so, you know, jealous of each other, or is it just in the nature of the people? Cahal, maybe you could take that one on. You're a neutral
observer.
I think
it's in the nature of people. Like we've all, it doesn't matter what form it takes, but the sort of idea of the valley of the squinting windows is there. People keeping an eye on each other and trying to, you know, get one step further up the ladder than the others, and to be critical of people who get above their station. And a lot of Craig Nakila is about that. Where one person's keeping an eye on another and describing their behaviour in relation to the way that they see themselves. Caitríona Foidín sees her sister being uppity. She sees other people, she casts aspersion on some of the other females in the graveyard, and in the end is absolutely horrified when she hears of the son going off to be a priest. She thinks that they've lost themselves entirely when that's going to happen, that they were never that good that this could possibly happen. And it permeates the whole book. But I think in anything which has a close look at Irish life, it's part of Irish life. It was then, it is now.
I think there's another aspect of it, Paul, that's interesting, which is that Craig Nakila and much of O'Kane's work is a perfect antidote to the kind of saintly view of life in the West of Ireland, so cherished by cultural nationalists for the first half of the 20th century. And what's interesting there is that Gaeltacht writers have never flinched from the darker side of their own world in representing it, whether it's Páirc O'Conara or even Páirc Óga O'Conara, who's writing about attempted rape and domestic violence and prostitution in Galway in 1939. And, you know, it should be required reading for people who still indulge in more cosy views of the circumstances of peasant community life in Ireland in the first half of the 20th century. The hardship and misery is inescapable in O'Kane, and also the backbiting and bitchiness of people who are forced into close proximity with each other.
And the control of the clergy and the shopkeepers of societies. It wasn't the idyllic Connemara of Pearse that O'Kane portrayed, Ciarán, was it?
No, well, it definitely wasn't the quiet man. I think, again, back to what Louis was saying, there are other elements to it. I think for Caitríona Kille, O'Kane obviously set out to present it in a dark way, or to show almost... I don't think there are any characters, especially the stage play, which I know better now. It's a long time since I read the book, and also the film adaptation of that. It's really a question of... all the characters are nasty characters, or at least if the best thing you could say about them is that they're kind of dull or stupid, you know, like it's kind of like Seinfeld. Everyone is fairly nasty. But at the same time, I think it was a different world. It might be the same now, but it's not as intense. At that time, that we, like Robert really wanted to do visually was to create the village. So that wherever we're always seeing the same people, and the people that die we have seen in other scenes, and their faces you get to know, and that was really what life was about. The village was the world, and you'd have they'd visit each other in the houses, and they'd know exactly what everyone else was doing, down to the smallest detail. So it's very hard not to... Now, there's a good positive side to that, and there was, but it's very hard not to know about the dirty laundry and everything else about the person that's living next door to you, because they travel from house to house, and every single detail was known by everybody.
When you decided to take on this film, what was your idea? Was it an homage to Mortian O'Kane, or were you genuinely sort of excited by the story, or did you feel a duty to put this masterpiece into film?
Well, all of the above, I suppose. definitely Martin O'Kane would, I would see him personally as an icon. In so much as, like, he did so many things, but for me particularly, that which he was involved with the Irish language and the forerunner of Cearta Sibhialta and the Gaeltachta and he even had a lot to do with, like, I'm from Rakharn originally, the Gaeltachta in Meath, and he had a lot to do with the campaigning to allow that to happen.
But he was central in the campaign. This, just to remind our listeners, this was a campaign in the 30s to move people from the congested areas of Connemara up to estates of big good land bought by the government.
Yeah, the absentee
county
landlords where the land was taken off them, which they'd stolen anyway, and it was kind of broken up into little plots and given to people from the west. Now, it began as a policy which was to be a lot bigger, a lot larger, but then, you know, as things happen very often with governments, you know, it became less and less a priority.
Like decentralisation at the moment.
So, yeah, well, I don't know about the moment, but so they campaigned to ensure that they followed with this policy. So in many ways, he had a lot to do with my life even before I was born. Both my parents were born in Rakharn. But definitely his stance on the language and he was a very sophisticated agitator, and he was a very modern thinking person. There's no doubt about that. Like, people connect him to the tradition, and he was a part of that. But in reality, he was a great manipulator of the media. He knew exactly what to do, what buttons to push, and he made sure that whatever he was behind got a lot of attention.
He was a fair thick man, Louis.
He was a very dangerous man. I mean, he was on the Army Council of the IRA in the mid-30s, and in that capacity he was opposed to the bombing campaign in England, but not because of the violence, but because he thought that the social programme which was to follow the violence, hadn't been properly thought out. At an earlier period when people were agitating against landlords in Connemara, his proposal, his most helpful suggestion, was to shoot a couple of landlords, that would be helpful. he considered himself, as he said quite proudly, marafach a gachter than da hang ifigula, deadly in either of the two official languages of the state, and clearly a contrarian, you know, to the bitter end. One of the things that's very interesting for a political agitator is that his politics is very unstable. You know, he shifts from one side to the other, even with moving people to Rakharn. He was opposed to that initially, and then he came around to another view of things. He was a real subversive, and when he was imprisoned, interned without trial during the Second World War, it was because he was actually a very dangerous man.
Let's go back to the film, Robert. When you were charged with this duty of presenting this masterpiece for the screen, did you look at other films, other influences for this type of work? What references did you use?
Well, above ground, I decided that we should make it look like a spaghetti western. And I know that's quite disrespectful to O'Kane and all the wonderful things he did, but I thought the best way to make this look interesting is to put as many rugged, ragged characters above ground as possible and equally below ground. Below ground was more difficult because, you know, who knows what it's like below ground. That's it, baby, I think, you know. But down below ground, we decided there's a film by Rodriguez called Sin City, and there's a sort of mercurial, weird feel about that, and we decided that we would try and make that our below ground, you know, to have the characters.
That was your visual reference, Lee.
Yeah, it really was, yeah. I mean, that's about as deep as it goes, you know, that's about as deep as it goes for me. But the above ground was more interesting because I enjoyed with the village that we built with Darren McGee, who had originally done the stage play with Mags Lennon and the costumes, you know.
Very good special effects people as well to make the transition between above ground and below ground.
It's absolutely fantastic. We did a lot of computer-generated imagery. We built a well above ground and below ground, a specific kind of underside of a well, which was completely generated in a computer. A guy called John Talbot did all of that for us in Dublin. We had a fantastic team.
Putting the film together, Ciarán, financially, it's a difficult thing taking on a film. Is it? Well, mind you, with the Gaeilge money, it should be handy enough to get money for a Gaeilge film, isn't it?
What Gaeilge money is this?
Well, I presume the BCI and all these people have
and
money
the BCI,
for
Gaeilge. Yeah, no, there's no doubt. T.G. Cahead and other people, as well as ourselves, have wanted to do something visual with Cailín na Cailleadh for a long time. However, it's a difficult one to fund, as it doesn't follow the structure of a novel, as Louis was saying, so it doesn't really follow the traditional structure of a film either. It's an arthouse movie, but there's no reason we can't have arthouse movies as Gaeilge as well as Béarla. But definitely, I'd say, in relation to us making a film, it wouldn't have happened without the BCI. T.G. Cahead were a big part of it, and then the BCI were willing to support us. And with that money in place, we were able to get private investment through Section 481.
And that's basically the structure. But it was a tight budget. It was a low-budget movie. We had 3 weeks to shoot, which is, I'd say, 50% of the usual thing for a feature. But we had a great team, great actors. Tim Fleming was the director of photography. He's a great cameraman. And there was more to it than that, though. There was a great morale and spirit about it. You know, we were there to do something which was very important. Those who worked with us knew the importance of it.
I think it was
the funniest shoot I was ever on, actually. I mean, seriously.
Yeah. In terms of humour or in terms of funny?
In terms of humour, the crew and the cast were having a wonderful time. The weather was terrific. The most bizarre things happened to us. I mean, the day before we started shooting, we lost two actors, one through leprosy or something like that. I don't know what the other person was. The first day of the shoot, our caterer ran out of the catering wagon on fire. I mean, I thought, nobody up there likes us. This is the most bizarre shoot I've ever been on. But the weather came out, the gods of the Gaels are with us, I guess.
What was I going to say to you? Well, somebody said to me during that film show, ladies and gentlemen, I participated in this movie myself in a small part, just mentioned that in passing. But while I was on the set, somebody said to me, if Ciarán had waited another 20 years, there wouldn't have been enough people in Connemara but enough Irish to understand this film or to make this film.
I do remember that Dermot MacInneister, one of our actors, said that it was probably the last generation of actors who could do justice to Cathaoine na Cille. Now, I might be a bit more dochasach or positive, optimistic than Dermot, but it could be true. Definitely the actors we've used, the very strong performance. We didn't use all of the people from the stage version, but most of them. And really, because we had no money for rehearsals, it worked out too, because they knew the script very, very well. They knew the characters very well. They were like musicians playing with a tune, as opposed to, you know, playing a tune for the first time. It cut down on a lot of our pre-production time, but it just, the performances are very, very strong.
Pinéad, would you agree with that this current generation of actors in Connemara would probably be the last generation of actors that would make do justice to that type of Irish, or the original Irish in Cathaoine na Cille?
Well, I don't know about that, Pádraig. I think if actors are trained, you know, I think if they... I mean, and that is a problem at the moment. Where is the training for actors as Gaeilge, if you know what I mean? I think if you have the training... You know, I think you'll take it on, you know, because it's as much about myself and taking it on the first, you know, when we did it first, like 10 years ago. I think because I've had the training and because I had done other work in Irish, say, Cúirte Mhol Oíche, I knew the bulk, you know, and what was ahead of me. And through that, I could, you know what I mean, I could sort of manage it. But I think... There isn't the training there for actors as Gaeilge.
I want to do another clip from the radio version of the novel Cathaoine na Cille, where this is the end where Catriona Foyd and yourself, Pádraig, finds out they're not going to put a cross on her. Listen to this, please.
Jack Nascolaga. Ni de glas lachinilan, the crushsa, na ma crushsa. Red. Harawa red. Yanin. Artin. Vigna crushate there. Can't heal na hulch of a kind. Sfeir troed na an twaignis. Nŵr i'n ddog... Nŵr i'n ddog... Nŵr Hara!
Pádraig, why was it so important to Catriona Foyden to get a slab stone of the granite from the island on her grave?
Well, I suppose it was, you know, that continuity for her, that she wasn't, you know, that she still existed in the other world. And that cross represented that for her. You know, she wasn't just a hole in the ground. She was still there. And I think that's, you know, that's what it meant for her.
Was it not a kind, Louis, mocking the peasants by saying that all they're concerned about really is being put in the pound spot in the graveyard and having a good cross on them?
Well, I think that is part of it, but it's also, you know, where any kind of social advancement is almost impossible. It's the kind of ultimate vanity. There's a wonderful short story by Daniel Cork, read at a school, called Vanity, about an old man dying in West Cork, and his vanity is that he wants the notice of his death to go into the better newspapers, and after he dies, the two sons are saying there's not a chance they're going to spend it on something so useless.
And that's what happened to Katrina Fogin as well.
But the idea of people are so reduced in their circumstances that they scrimp and save so that at least in death there'll be some kind of elegance and distinction that differentiates them from others, and it doesn't happen. I mean, it's actually very tragic, the end. I mean, it's just listening to that clip there, there's a horrible loneliness, and the scream when Breed screams there, it's just the emptiness of the whole thing. It's quite extraordinary. Mm. You know, that just this one little thing where she might succeed in death, where her life was marked by failure and everything else from romance right through, and even that isn't going to happen.
It's kind of sad, Ciarán, was it? The end?
Well, there's two ways of looking at it. You know, it's sad. It's tragic anyway. But at the same time, as Tom Rua would say, you know, why would we be bothered about whether we have a cross over us or not? Why would you care where they throw your bones? So yeah, there are two sides. I think O'Kane, although he saw it as a tragedy for Cathaoir na Foidean, I think at the same time was making little of the surach, the pettiness of human existence.
The pettiness of human existence.
I think another thing worth mentioning is the fact that it's an entirely godless existence. I think.
But they do say it's like the old country down here, don't they?
they do, but they don't seem to be going anywhere. You know, they're still going on.
Tell us about what you're doing very, very quickly for the RT Radio 1 for commemorating O'Kane.
Beginning last Friday, 5 Friday nights at 8 o'clock, we have special commemoration programmes. Next Friday, it's Papa Ruana agus Papa Vraka, part of the lecture that we heard earlier on in the programme, and an interview that followed that lecture, particularly about his criticisms of the number and quality of Gaelic language poets at the time. The week after that is another lecture that O'Kane gave himself, Conradh na Gaeilge agus an Litríocht, as part of the Gaelic League idea. The week after that I'm doing a programme on his polemical writings and political writings, and then we finish it off with a discussion on O'Kane and his relevance today.
Fair play to you. That's work to look forward to on RT Radio 1. I really enjoyed the one last Friday night. That's our lot for tonight. That's the 11th hour coming to an end. My many thanks to Louis Dupuyr, Cathal Portier, Ciarán na Coffey, Robert Quinn and Breed ní Neachtain. Cé na Cille, produced by Ciarán Avrás, Ciarán directed by Robert, will be screened on TG Cahead in the new year. I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the 11th hour podcast. The 11th hour is live on RT Radio 1, Mondays to Fridays at 11 p.m. From me, Páraic Branagh, and the rest of the team in the 11th hour, Slán.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/radio1.